So, but where I think we learned a lot is just interacting with the Christian leaders there who are of a theistic evolutionary bent. We were speaking both on the Regent Seminary campus and also Trinity Western University. And that's kind of a place where there's a lot of controversy going on in terms of theistic evolution. Fuzz debated Dennis Venema, who's the chairman of the biology department at Trinity Western, twice. And I got to debate an atheist, and the joke was it's a little bit easier debating an atheist than a Christian. But my debates with Rob Tarswell, who's a professor at the University of British Columbia, it was interesting because the audience was like 95% atheists and skeptics from the Free Thinkers Society there. So it's about 300 of them. And so that made it interesting because they totally dominated the Q&A time and just hearing their responses. And I thought what was interesting about my time with Rob is he freely admitted that an atheistic worldview implies that we really have no more meaning and purpose than a piece of dust or a stone. And that was kind of the last thing he said to the audience is that, you know, you basically have no worth, you're all nothing. That's the way it is, given that there is no God. So, but, you know, listening to all the atheists coming to the microphone, the passion they have about God's non-existence tells me they must really believe he exists. Because I think that's quite similar to what I saw here in Pasadena when I debated Victor Stenger in front of the Skeptic Society. Is this extreme passion about the God of the Bible where the gods of the other religions of the world basically get ignored. And so for some reason all the focus is on the God of the Bible, not say the God of Hinduism or Buddhism. And so my response in Vancouver was, I think all of you really do believe that the God of the Bible exists, it's that you just don't like him very much. So, and their response was similar to what I heard when I was in front of the Skeptic Society. Well, it's not so much God we're upset about. It's all of his followers. And so the real problem is they don't like Christians. And once again, just like what happened here in Pasadena, I heard story after story of people's way they had been mistreated by Christians when they're growing up. Almost all of their stories, it's something that happened when they were a child or a youth. And usually it's just one person. And, you know, what I shared with them is what you see in Matthew 7. If you will not forgive others, God will not forgive you. And it's based on the principle that no one has suffered more than Christ on our behalf. And when you say, I can't forgive so-and-so for what he did to me, you're basically saying that I have suffered more than Christ has suffered. And none of us can make that claim. That's really an expression of pride. But there again, I like what I see at the end of the book of Job. We human beings can tame all these incredible animals, but there's one creature we can't tame, and that's our fellow human being. Only God is really capable of bringing humility to a proud human being. So that was my prayer for these folks. Interestingly, I went out to dinner with a bunch of the Atheist Club leaders, and they kind of like hanging with us, so we had a good time. But once again, I got to hear a lot more of their personal stories. And it's like, you know, people are letting human beings get between them and God. And, you know, that's really not a rational approach, but I think it's a very common one with humanity. Is a couple of people rub us the wrong way, and somehow that prevents us from really coming to grips with the mercy and love of God. Yes?
No, actually, this was in the paper that an atheist married an agnostic. And they didn't know what religion not to bring their kids up.
There you go. Well, Allison, you come from a Jewish background. I got to tell you this one. I've probably heard the best ethnic joke I've ever heard when I was in Vancouver.
Don't call me out. You're going to confuse me with him.
Well, by the way, we need to do that because I found out when I was in Vancouver, a lot of people in the Vancouver area. In fact, I found this also to be true in Seattle. They listen to the MP3s of this class. And they're asking me, you know, Hugh, can you please call up people's names when they're asking questions? I said, well, I'm terrible knowing people's names. I'm going to have to get all of you to wear name tags. So, but it made me aware that this class is much larger than just what we see here. It's just been, you know, dozens of people I met in Vancouver actually listen to our class faithfully week after week. So, yeah, and they're always having problems distinguishing between the two Al's. So I need to, one of these got to be called Al and the other one's got to be called Al.
Alan.
That's Alan and Al. That's a good way to do it.
What's the joke?
What's the joke? Well, I was told to me by a Mennonite pastor, and he said, you know, years ago, the Mennonite church in Canada was just for Mennonites. But he says there's so few evangelical churches that are holding to the Bible as the inerrant word of God that the Mennonites have been forced to reach out to all manner of ethnic backgrounds in Canada. So it's really hard to pick the real Mennonites out in the Mennonite churches. But this guy says, here's how you do it. A Mennonite is someone who can buy from a Jew and sell to a Scot and make a tidy profit.
I got one for you.
Well, I've already heard yours about the Ten Commandments. If you've never heard his Ten Commandment joke, you got to talk to Alan. He's got a great Ten Commandment joke. You got another one? You got another one besides your
Ten? It's a little longer, but I'll tell you something.
All right, okay.
Do you have an incredibly sexy voice, or is that your cold?
Yeah, that's my cold. I mean, as I said, my driver was quite ill, and I spent many hours. It was cold outside. We had to roll the windows up, so.
Oh, I wasn't here when you said that.
I'm recovering from that. But it was a very educational experience for me, even though I was, you know, speaking, you know, 12, 13 times. I got to listen to both Fuzz's debates, and also got to speak to a lot of professors, both at Regent Seminary and at Trinity Western. And kind of what we've been talking about in the class here, how, you know, people who call themselves theistic evolutionists, they're really all over the spectrum. I met a couple of professors at Trinity Western who identified themselves as theistic evolutionists, but I found out their theology is really quite close to ours. And yet when I heard Fuzz debate and also talked to, and by the way, it's not just science professors, but theology professors. But I think I was more disturbed by what I heard from certain theology professors, and that is this idea that the idea that human beings are physical and then there's a spirit within us, they're actually claiming that's a Greek concept that was kind of pushed into the New Testament, and it's really not true. It's not kind of an Israelite idea. That the Hebrew concept is that, you know, we just simply have a physical nature and that's it. And, you know, to me that's quite disturbing. And they actually found out they were very upset about my book on Job, because they said, in your book on Job, you claim that there is life that's purely physical, life that's physical and soulish, kind of like the higher animals that are endowed with the capacity to relate to us human beings, relate to one another, and human beings who are body, soul, and spirit. And I was rather surprised to discover that they're promoting the view that we're kind of all the same and that we really don't have a dual nature. We only have a one nature, and we're really no different than the rest of life here on planet Earth. We simply differ from them by degree and not by kind, which is the argument you see in Charles Darwin's book, Descent of Man, that there's really no difference in the different life forms on the Earth, just that we're a little more intelligent than the other life forms, but we're really no different than the rest of all life in any distinct way. Yes?
Theistic evolutionists, by and large, acknowledge that God is a spirit and the creation of the universe was a miracle, or if God is a spirit and we're made in His image, what do they say? They say that we didn't inherit His spirit?
Well, that's a good question. What do they all hold in common? And they probably, if you look across the spectrum of theistic evolutionists, the differences are far greater than what they have in common. But I think what I've discovered they all share in common, they do believe that God is spirit. They do believe that God created a miracle in bringing the universe into existence. Every one of them I talk to accepts Big Bang cosmology. They all say that, you know, when God creates, it's a combination of natural process and divine miraculous intervention. And that's kind of where Fuzz began his debate with Dennis Venema, is to say, well, let's start where we agree. We look at Genesis 1, it does teach both. But what's interesting about the two debates is that, beyond the Big Bang creation event, we weren't able to see where Venema was willing to say that God miraculously intervened. So apparently the entire origin and history of life is pure natural process. Although, to be fair to Venema, he does say that, God may have intervened there. We just can't see it or prove it. We can only do that for the Big Bang creation event. And I think that was a surprise to me and Fuzz and other people up there, is that we thought for sure there'd be a concession, at least on the origin of life. But there wasn't. There's a feeling that, origin of life researchers will find a naturalistic solution to how life comes about. I think what also the whole principle, as I talked on the Trinity Western campus, the thing I was trying to emphasize over and over again, you want to interpret the complex sciences in the light of the simple sciences. And the first origin of life, 3.8 billion years ago, is a far simpler problem than where the human spirit comes from, or where, the DNA of human beings arises. Because I think the theme we were hearing both at Regent Seminary and at Trinity Western University, and by the way, I'm not trying to put a paintbrush across Trinity Western. A lot of the faculty there are strong supporters of what we stand for here at Reasons to Believe. In fact, I would say the majority are very strong supporters. But they feel pressure from their students, who predominantly come from young earth creationist families. And then they feel pressure from theology professors and biology professors on their campus, who are taking this rather extreme form of a theistic evolution. But then I've met other theistic evolutionists there who say, oh yeah, we see miracles throughout the whole thing. We just want to emphasize that it's not all miracles. And I say, well, what's our position of Reasons to Believe? You look at Genesis 1, look at the variety of words. It uses the verb, deshah, hayah, let there be, let the land produce, but it also says God makes and God creates. And so it's not either or, it is both and. And it's quite explicit, where you're going to expect to find one or the other. But I did run into a debate with a theology, Old Testament theology professor, who insisted that all those verbs that you see in Genesis 1 basically mean the same. That none of them demand in any way divine miraculous intervention. And I said, what about the universe? And he says, well, I'm not sure that's the case for the universe either. He doesn't say. He says, I really don't see the Bible teaching creation ex nihilo. And I said, what about, Hebrews 11:3? The universe that we can detect did not come from that which we can detect. And he says, what's your interpretation? But that's kind of one end of the extreme, and then it goes to the other end. Yes?
The theology professors that you referenced that don't believe in the spirit versus the physical, I assume that those individuals do not hold to the inerrancy of Scripture, because in Scripture you see plenty of cases where who have disembodied spirits existing apart from it, any physical, because they're disembodied. And so therefore, they must discount all those accounts in Scripture where there are spiritual beings apart, human beings that have died, or like the saints that
Well,
are martyred.
I actually pose those kinds of questions, and what I'm discovering is that there are a few, very few, who explicitly say that biblical inerrancy must be abandoned. Most of them say it needs to be redefined. And so they actually will say, yeah, I do believe in biblical inerrancy, but not the same way you do. In other words, and it's similar to what I saw happening. In fact, what reminds me going on here at these conservative Christian universities and seminaries is what I saw taking place, say, at Fuller Seminary, 25, 30 years ago, where people were saying, yes, we do believe in biblical inerrancy, where it applies to faith and practice and doctrine, but not geography, history, or science. Of course, then the problem becomes, where do you draw the line between history, geography, and science, and faith, practice, and doctrine? And you know, why would God let some of his word be inerrant, not other parts of his word be inerrant? And some of the subtleties that are coming out, there's a book published by Peter Enns called Incarnation and Inspiration, or it might be the other way around, Inspiration and Incarnation, where he argues that just like when Jesus came to earth, he was both human and divine, likewise God, in inspiring the words of the Bible, partnered with the human authors, but partnered in such a way that he basically took a back seat and let the errors of the human authors come through. But nevertheless, the Holy Spirit renders the important stuff inerrant, but lets the humanness and the propensity to commit errors of the human authors to stand. Now, a quick rebuttal to that is what you see in Peter's first letter, chapter 1, where he says these prophets of old longed to understand what the Holy Spirit was inspiring to write, but had to acknowledge that what they were being inspired to write was for a future generation to fully comprehend. That, of course, is a paraphrase. What you see there, I think it's 1 Peter 1:12, states it much more succinctly than that, but that's the main point. And, you know, if that's really the case, then that really does mean that the Holy Spirit is not taking a back seat role, but really a front seat role. I do agree that God, in inspiring the different books of the Bible, allows the personality and the writing style of the human authors to come through. But as you look at the International Council of Biblical Inerrancy statements, it's that, yes, God allowed the personality, the writing style to come through, but he rendered everything that these prophets and apostles wrote that make up our Bible error-free in every respect. So, yeah, got a follow-up?
Spiritually deny really original sin. They deny the effects of sin. They really have to deny logically your eternal nature. I mean, they're getting into all sorts of doctrinal issues.
Well, I would agree that if you're saying that we human beings are purely physical and we don't differ in any significant or distinctive respect with respect to the rest of the animals and plants that we see on the planet, then that does begin to impact major doctrines. But I'll tell you where the debate really focused was this idea that, you know, we have Romans and Luke and Acts speaking about how all of us human beings are descended from Adam and Eve. And then we have people working in the Human Genomics Project who are saying, when you actually do the genomic studies, it looks like that we're descended from no fewer than 1,200 individuals. And therefore, we have to reinterpret what it says in Romans 5, in the book of Acts, and in Luke. And they're looking at ways to defend biblical inerrancy, but to reinterpret those passages where they become figures of speech rather than Paul literally saying that we all inherited sin through the one man, Adam. Adam, they would claim, is simply a type. Or I've seen some say that, God picked two individuals out of these 1,200 to 7,000 human beings that are running around, made Homo sapiens, Homo spiritus, and then somehow through those two, the Spirit was extended upon all the rest. So that's some of the ways that they're trying to retain a literal meaning of what you see there in Romans 5. Most theologians would argue that that's really stretching the text, and that when I talk to these theistic evolutionists who do want to hold the biblical inerrancy, they will frankly admit Romans 5 is their biggest challenge. Because it seems very difficult to read Romans 5 in anything other than a literal, straightforward communication that indeed we're all descended from Adam and Eve. But I'd really appreciate how Fuzz did. I think, we did record the debates, but we've agreed not to distribute them. So they're not going to be distributed, but we do have a record. But Fuzz gave me these 8 papers. And basically what these 8 papers are communicating is that the confidence with which people in the Human Genomics Project are saying we must be descended from no fewer than 1,200 individuals is disturbing by the fact that there's a number, these 8 papers, Fuzz has collected them from over the past 5 years, And these papers are basically documenting you can't trust genomic studies to give you an idea of an ancestral population, or for that matter, an ancestral date. And one of the papers just got published literally a few weeks ago, and it was a group of researchers who tried to come up with a date for the first man based on Y chromosome analysis. And gee, for 15 years now, the date has been 42,000 to 56,000 years ago is when the first man lived based on Y chromosome analysis. And what they did is they went to Africa and looked at several, they picked groups in Africa that display significant genetic diversity, not within a particular tribe, but when they compared tribe to tribe. So they took these seven different tribes where they saw very significant diversity. And what's interesting is that you can have two black tribes living in close proximity to one another, and the genetic difference between one tribe and the other is greater than that between, say, blacks and whites or Asians and whites. So they picked this area where they have this great diversity. Then they tried to build what's called a patrilineal tree. In other words, a tree through the men, because only we men get the Y chromosome. But they wound up coming up with a date of 142,000 years ago. And, Fuzz gave me this and said, what this really demonstrates is you really can't count on either mitochondrial DNA analysis or Y chromosome analysis either giving you an accurate date for the first man or the first woman, or for that matter, giving you any sense of the ancestral population. And as I read through the eight papers that Fuzz gave me, I think he's onto something, that genomics is so incredibly complex with non-linearity all over the place. And that's kind of what I saw coming from these theistic evolutionists, is the idea that they're dealing with linear equations. For example, that the mutation rate is constant throughout human history. And there's plenty of evidence that that's not true. In fact, there's plenty of evidence that's not true for any mammalian species or any bird species. One of these papers looks at birds and said, birds are really the place to test these different ideas. Why? Because it's quite easy to get an idea of the total population of a bird species because they're flying around all the time. So it's a little bit easier to count. Mammals are a little more difficult because they dig in the ground. Who knows how many of them really are sitting around. So they said birds are really the way to put these theories to the test. And a number of these studies are looking at birds and saying, when you look at the genetic diversity of birds in the current population, it gives you no idea of the ancestral population or the date for those different bird species, which probably means DNA analysis is really not a good tool for determining the ancestral population or the date. And I'm kind of agreeing with Fuzz that if you want to get a scientific date for the origin of humanity, the best way to do it is through cultural big bangs. When's the first use of clothing? When's the first use of jewelry? When do you see the first use of advanced tools, music, art, and religious expression? Because there you're getting dates that might vary by plus or minus 50%. In the case of the DNA stuff, it varies by plus or minus 300%. And so, but I think what I found most disturbing in talking to these professors is this idea that they put tremendous confidence on a research discipline where things are extremely complex, where the equations really do appear to be nonlinear in nature, and yet they're drawing conclusions with great confidence. I hear him saying this is as settled a matter as the law of gravity. And it's like, hey, wait a minute, you're talking to a physicist. when we're talking about the law of gravity and, say, the physics of stars, and even, I can tell you this as an astrophysicist, it took us astrophysicists 50 years before we were confident that our understanding of the physics of stars was sufficiently adequate that we could actually determine precise dates for the burning times of different categories of stars. And I remember in the early days, the presumption was, yes, we're dealing with linear equations, relatively easy to solve, and we came up with models that fairly closely matched the observations, but not exactly. I think the principle there is the way you know you're on to something in science is where you're coming with more and more detailed theoretical models to explain the history of the phenomena. At the same time, you're coming with observations to confirm or deny those theoretical models, And as time goes on, the models get better and better, the observations get better and better, and consequently the agreement gets better and better. If the agreement gets worse and worse, then you know you probably don't understand the whole thing. In fact, I can remember, 40 years ago when we were doing these stellar models, and people finally figured out, well, the interiors of stars are quite simple, but not the atmospheres. Once you get into the atmospheres of small stars, you've got nasty things like molecules. In some cases, you've got atoms with electrons on it. Makes things very messy. And you have to build a detailed atmospheric model. That set the discipline back about 30 years until they came up with sufficiently sophisticated atmosphere models that you could actually come up with good dates. Today, it's kind of a solved problem. So, you know, that's about the simple. That's an idea. You know, it took 50 years with something that was very simple. Because stars are 100% gas from the surface to the interior. You know, they obey the law of gravity. They obey the gas laws. They obey the electromagnetic laws of James Clerk Maxwell. I mean, what could be simpler? And even with something as simple as that, it literally took 50 years before we finally got complete agreement between the theory and the observations.
But they don't agree with quantum theory, do they?
Oh, yeah, we actually, I mean, for example, when you're looking at neutron stars, you've got to take quantum mechanics into effect because, after all, you've got neutrons touching one another and they form a crystal lattice. So, yeah, you wind up having them all in what's called a degenerate state. And sometimes what's funny is, you know, many people walk in at our meetings, they hear us talking about degeneracy and degenerate stars, and they're thinking we're making a spiritual statement. No, we're not. So, yes.
Well, it seems to me, as a non-scientist, but I see this all the time, that science doesn't sit still. Regarding the 1200, science never finds the end of anything. I mean, it's a wonderful process. But they keep pushing back. And so they're down to maybe 1,200 or a little more. But as they learn more, it's easy to imagine that number would shrink.
Well, it already has shrunk, because I remember when that number was above a million. So the number's been getting smaller and smaller as we learn more and more. In fact, that 1,200 number, I saw that for the first time. That was in Vancouver, because what I've been reading in the literature was 2,000. So it's gone from 2,000 down to 1,200. So it's like, hey, it's going in the right direction. That was kind of Fuzz's appeal. Let's let the science play out and see where it ends up. But we're nowhere near to the right answer. And, you know, Fuzz made two presentations. He said, you know, we're already doing some experiments to put these genomics models to the test. And one was with MUFON sheep, and the other one was with Rogozhinsky horse. And what they did with these MUFON sheep, they took a female and a male that were highly inbred and put them on one of the Kerguelen Islands. I don't know if you've ever heard of Kerguelen, but it's kind of an island about half the size of Newfoundland. It's down in the South Indian Ocean, very isolated place. So you're guaranteed that if you put something there, nothing else is going to interfere with it. And they put a couple of these sheep on one of the islands that outlie Kerguelen. And they let it run for many generations. Then they looked at the genetic diversity. The genetic diversity was far higher than what any geneticist would have predicted. But we now have a second example, and that's with a Przewalski horse. And again, highly inbred. And when they actually did the genetic studies with a couple, they discovered the same thing. They got way more genetic diversity than what any model had predicted, which means the models are too simple. And we don't understand the models in sufficient depth to give any confidence or trust in the idea that genetic diversity in any way gives you an idea of a population. I'll just read you some of the titles here. This one got published in Science. It says, population size does not influence mitochondrial genetic diversity in animals. Put it the other way around, genetic diversity really doesn't give you any idea of the ancestral population size. Or this one here. Determination of mitochondrial genetic diversity in mammals. And it says the whole focus was on mammals because that's where all this debate is right now. But just made the point that genetic diversity is unrelated to the ancestral population size. And there's six other papers with titles like that. Evidence for variation in the effect of population size of animal mitochondrial DNA. And just makes the point once again that the mitochondrial DNA really is not a trustworthy measure. Is genetic diversity really higher in large populations? And what they're discovering, for example, is that when you look at invertebrates and compare them with vertebrates, invertebrates have been around for a lot longer. Their populations are far larger than they are for the vertebrates, and yet the genetic diversity in each species is the same when you compare invertebrates to vertebrates. All this tells us we don't understand all the ins and outs of genetics and genomics. There's a lot more work to be done. Moreover, what I tried to communicate when I was at Trinity Western, when you're looking at human beings, if you actually get some confidence in what the Bible teaches in the early chapters of Genesis, there's another factor in the genetic diversity of human beings. Because there was a time when human beings had the potential to live 900 plus years, as opposed to a maximum of 120 right now. Now, the only way you're going to be able to live to be 900 years is if somebody messes or deals with your genetics. And therefore, when God said, I'm going to shorten human lifespans down to 120, he had to change the genetics of human beings so that we wouldn't be able to live that long. And actually, by the way, given our radiation environment, it's a good thing that God intervened to change our genetics. Otherwise, we'd be dying much earlier deaths from cancer. And so the problem here is that, you've got your chromosomes getting shorter and shorter as the cells replace one another, and there reaches a time in your life where the chromosomes are so short that your body no longer is able to function, and so you die, which is the reason why nobody can live much beyond 120 years, the limit you see in Genesis 6:3. But if you're not dealing with a radiation environment that's as high as what we live in right now, then there's no need for the chromosomes to shorten quite so aggressively. But to explain how the chromosomes weren't shortening so aggressively to where they're shortening aggressively, that really does require a divine intervention. And that being the case, then trying to look at the diversity of present-day human beings in terms of their genomics and trying to discern what was going on at the time of Adam and Eve, that's really not going to get you anywhere if God actually intervened in the process. And there are people that speculate that God may have also intervened at the time of dispersal of human beings from Mesopotamia into all the parts of the world, what you see in Genesis 11 and Genesis 10, where it says God gave us different languages. And some people speculate that there might have been some genetic intervention on God's part there, especially if that included racial distinctives and genetic or ethnic distinctives. So not knowing where God intervened and to what degree he intervened, well, we got a pretty good idea when, but not knowing the degree to which he intervened or how he intervened means that using present-day human genetic diversity really is a useless tool to trace back to what was going on in Adam and Eve. And I think what we learned from the MUFON sheep and the Przewalski horse, these are experiments done where they take a pair of animals that we already know are highly inbred. Very different situation where God takes a male and a female and gives them an optimized DNA and an optimized diversity from the male to the female and then runs the population forward. Clearly, you're going to get greater diversity if you're running with a pair that is not genetically inbred as compared to these MUFON sheep and Przewalski horses. Buzz's claim is we need a lot more experiments before we have any confidence that these theories that we have in human genomics are actually in any way reliable. Yeah.
Says the problem is that physics appears to be leading us not into resolution, like the theory of everything, but into an Alice in Wonderland world of increasingly bizarre theories, each further removed from the last from our experience of everyday world. Number one is untold number of universes that bubble up with constantly from quantum frogs or boom. Number two, the string theory, which suggests the existence of seven extra dimensions beyond the four we already know, and the LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, to it's important is for us to understand why we can observe only a portion of what our theories of matter predict. If scientists have to dream up dimensions that nobody has ever seen and universes that nobody will ever find, perhaps we're headed toward a blind alley and we're getting into the realm of what? Supernatural, right? We have to have faith. These things are there. Nobody knows they're there.
Well, that's a common joke, Al, in physics, is that certain of our journals of physics really aren't physics journals. They're metaphysics journals. Because most of the papers published, say, in physics letters B, are outside of the realm of reality. But there's a reason why we allow those papers to be published. Because it gives these physicists the opportunity to engage in extremely esoteric mathematics that they find quite fun and enjoyable just on its own basis. But there's always the possibility that in developing some new esoteric mathematics that somewhere down the road it'll actually have a practical application. And so there's a freedom given to these physicists to engage in that kind of speculation, just quote for the fun of it. And I would argue that's not entirely an anti-biblical principle. After all, you've got Paul telling us in 1 Corinthians 2:9 that no one can think or imagine how great and wonderful the rewards and pleasures of the new creation will be. But it's the same apostle Paul that says, you know, stretch your mind every day and try to think how wonderful it will be and realize it's better than that. And therefore, I mean, one sense, we should be given one another freedom to do that. We're critical of these physicists. Is their failure to have in the first paragraph of their paper, I acknowledge this has got nothing to do with physical reality, this can't be physically tested, this isn't really science. Nevertheless, I think there's some ways that we can engage in mathematical tools that might have some application, and, you know, after all, this might stretch our thinking in ways that we've never thought about before. A word in defense of string theory. I don't like them saying seven dimensions. I think six is more appropriate. So
I'm going to have to put the science into my world-famous supernatural bubble.
Well, the seventh dimension is something that's beyond any possibility of scientific testing, but not the six.
It'll be alongside religion.
Okay. No, and you'll see this defended in my book, Beyond the Cosmos, is that we're talking about is length, width, and height, where you've got six very tiny space dimensions that accompany the three big ones of length, width, and height. And the reason why physicists are persuaded that this has got to be true, it's really the only way that you can have a universe with quantum mechanics and gravity coexisting. And the story is this. The universe begins with nine dimensions of space that are all equal to one another, rapidly expanding from the cosmic creation event. But at the moment that gravity separates out from the other three forces of physics, six of those space dimensions stop expanding. And so those six are no bigger in size than what they were when the universe was 10 to the minus 43 seconds old. So that's pretty close to the beginning. And because we're talking that close to the beginning, those dimensions are no bigger than 10 to the minus 35 meters. That's 20 orders of magnitude smaller than the diameter of an electron. That's how tiny those dimensions are. And therefore, that's why nobody's really noticed them until 25 years ago. That's the first time people even recognized that these dimensions might be around. And it was simply discovered by particle physicists who realized that there's not enough room within length, width, and height for all the symmetries demanded by both quantum mechanics and gravity. So this was discovered at Caltech about almost 25 years ago by a physicist there by the name of John Schwartz. He says, we've got to have more room, and the only way to get more room is with more dimensions. But you only need that extra room when the universe is exceptionally young. So, and by the way, it also solved eight problems in physics when they came up with those six extra dimensions. And it was Stephen Hawking who said, we don't understand black holes. You know, when he first proposed the idea of white holes and black holes, we said they got a problem, namely that black holes suck up information and never let it out. Well, the discovery that the six dimensions, extra dimensions, are required to get quantum mechanics and gravity to coexist solved these two black hole problems. Anyway, you can read chapter 3 in the book. I describe for you all the things that string theory solves and why we're convinced that some kind of model involving six extra dimensions must be true, which, by the way, doesn't necessarily demand a string theory solution. It's quite possible that what people call string theories is not what's really going on with these dimensions, but where you will find physicists persuaded that we're on the right track, they do agree we need these extra dimensions. But there's a big dispute over whether there's more than the six. People speculate that there might be a seventh, but that usually gets into these multiverse speculations. And now we're beyond what we can actually prove to be true. It was Einstein who said, if God made two universes, once you got observers in universe A, the space-time envelope or surface of that universe can never overlap the space-time surface of any other possibly existing universe, which means we'll never get a theory of everything. You know, a lot of physicists say we're on a quest to find the holy grail where we're going to have a complete theory of physics. Well, as long as you're stuck inside this universe where you can't get outside, it's impossible to come up with a complete theory. That was something proven by Kurt Gödel, the German philosopher, back in 1930, called the incompleteness theorem. If you're trapped inside a system, it's impossible to learn everything about that system. And clearly, we human beings are trapped. We're never going to know everything. Now, God, who's outside the system, can know everything, but we who are confined to the system can't know everything. But I'll tell you this, that's extremely disturbing to a number of physicists I know, this idea that we human beings will not come up with a theory of everything. There's something about my fellow physicists who really think that they can know everything that can possibly be known.
This guy says that when he reached that point, he says we're like priests and not scientists, because they, you know, so speculative and so unprovable. You know, it's way out there. You know, different universes that can't talk to each other and stuff like that. That's what he said. You have to take it on faith.
Well, what's scary to me is people like Stephen Hawking who say that they're on a quest to know as much as God knows and to gain the mind of God. And the Bible is quite clear that's never going to happen. But also makes clear that's the ultimate expression of human pride, the idea that we could become like God. So we're in trouble. Yeah, go ahead. You've had your hand up a long time.
This goes back to the DNA studies. I was talking with Hunter recently, and he commented that within one generation, domesticated pigs completely changed their genetics to become feral pigs. And I didn't take it all that seriously. And then you're saying something similar with certain domesticated sheep. Have you heard, does this go on? Because I know certain domesticated pigs become feral very rapidly. And he says it's within one generation and their genetics change at the same time.
Well, I'm convinced there's things going on in genetics that nobody really understands. I mean, if you don't know the mechanisms, then how can you have any confidence in trying to use present-day diversity of different species, especially of mammals? I mean, we're very complicated. And, therefore, I don't think human genetic diversity really gives you much of a clue of anything. In fact, I'm even suspicious that you can use human genetic diversity, present-day human genetic diversity, to figure out where the Garden of Eden is. I mean, one of these papers I'm reading says, oh, it's got to be in Northwest Africa, because that's where we're seeing the greatest genetic diversity. So that's assuming you know everything that's, you know, building your genomics model. And yeah, the study you're referring to, the study with these MUFON sheep and Przewalski horses, tells us there's a lot of stuff going on there we don't see. We don't understand the equations. The assumption that we're dealing with linear equations is certainly can't be true. I mean, we run into nonlinear equations, even in plasma physics, where things are orders of magnitude simpler. Therefore, I think it's to be expected we're going to be seeing that in the area of biology. But I think what's happening is you've got all these biologists who are just really hoping that they can reduce their biological theories to pure mathematics, and therefore make the same kind of headway that physicists and geophysicists and astronomers have made. But the problem is, they're dealing with a subject matter that's orders of magnitude more complicated than, say, the gas that makes up a star, or the fluid that makes up a raindrop. by the way, as difficult it is to come up with an understandable model of the history of a star, it's even more difficult to come up with a model for the history of a raindrop. But I would argue a human being or a bacterium is orders of magnitude more complex than a raindrop. So, therefore, I think we're a little bit naive in thinking we've got a complete understanding in the discipline of genomics, and that complete understanding, quote, is causing us to overthrow what we know in the other sciences. That's kind of something that disturbed me, too, is that, you know, they were like this, taking a very complex, poorly understood science and using that to overthrow understanding of all these other scientific disciplines. So, but I think that's also a symptom of the fact that people over-specialize these days. Yeah, go ahead.
I saw a series about a year or two ago hosted by Alan Alda. It was called The Spark of Life, I think,
mm-hmm.
or The Human Spark. And I believe they said 100,000 or maybe even 200,000 years ago. If you took a man or whatever they were, homo, if you brought them back in this day and age, their brain, they could go through college. Now, I don't know if that says anything bad about the college, but what's your comment on that? They never mentioned God at all in this series.
No, but what they probably were talking about is the fact that when we dig up humans that have been dead, I think the one that they dug up the most ancient is about 30,000 years ago. You recover that DNA, compare it with the DNA of humans that are alive today, we can't see a difference outside of the diversity range of humans on the planet today. So it shows that humans that lived 30,000 years ago apparently were no different than we human beings today. And then they've done the same thing with Neanderthals. They've got mitochondrial DNA now from at least 20 different specimens. But as they look at the diversity of those 20 specimens, they can't see a historical trend, which tells us that the most ancient Neanderthals really weren't any different than the most recent. Now, with Homo erectus, we don't have any DNA that's trustworthy. I mean, we do have DNA, but it's so corrupted we can't use it to draw any conclusions. When you look at these skeletons of these Homo erectus specimens, again, we can't see any change with respect to time. So that tells us that these species are not evolving in any significant way. And given those three examples, yes, we would conclude that Adam was just as capable of going through Harvard University as anybody alive on the planet today, probably even a little more capable because, you know, provably the human species has suffered some genetic decay. So we probably aren't as advanced as the first humans.
Now, you said humans can never really know everything, the theory of everything. Well, what about when you die, after you die, your spirit? Will you know things then, or when you say never, do you mean eternally never?
Well, I don't think we'll ever gain the mind of God no matter how long we live on into eternity. We'll always be learning. I think one of the joys of the new creation is the education process we'll be undergoing there. We'll be learning new stuff literally every minute that we're there, and it's going to be enjoyable. It won't be as stressful as going through a set of courses in university today. You'll actually enjoy your education, and we'll enjoy teaching one another. After all, it says that we'll be teachers over the angels, so we're going to be instructing the angels, but evidently we'll be instructed as well.
Will I be starring my own sitcom?
Well, maybe there won't be sitcoms. I don't know. Maybe something better than sitcoms.
No.
There you go. So.
And I don't have to go to Hebrew school anymore.
I don't know what language we'll be speaking in heaven. So, yes.
You might recall a couple of weeks ago I showed you an article about the earliest paint pot ever found. It was roughly 100,000 years ago. So that gives rise to the question, how do you determine the earliest appearance of Homo sapiens sapiens? I mean, you just said a little earlier that it's based on explosion events, like the appearance of domesticated animals and stuff like that, and art. So how does that discovery affect your estimate of your earliest?
Well, okay, what I'm getting at is this. If you try to get dates based on genomics, the error bars are much larger than they are in terms of the cultural artifacts. But the cultural artifacts also have large error bars. So I think at best we're nailing down these dates to about a factor of two. I mean, keep in mind we don't have any good radiometric tools at the time of the birth of humanity. You know, carbon-14 only takes you back to about 30,000 years before the technique begins to break down. And then you got to go back to millions of years before you got a reliable radiometric tool. So there's a gap there where we lack good tools. And typically what they're doing in terms of trying to date these archaeological finds is use things like thermoluminescence or optical luminescence, but those give you upper limits. So when you see that date of 100,000 years, that's 100,000 years or less. Now, how much less? They've done studies where it shows it can be up to a factor of 20 times less. So instead of 100,000 years, we may find that it's really only 5,000 years. Now, usually you can rule that out, because if it's really 5,000 years, you should be able to do a carbon-14 date that will show you that it's young and not old. But that happened at the Jimbian Cave in Australia, where for years people were claiming it proved that the Aborigines arrived there 60,000 years ago, until they found some carbon there that they could date from the site, and they revised the date to 3,000 years ago. So that's an example. We're 60,000 and all the way down to 3,000. Now, where you can make headway with this, thermoluminescence will decay at a different rate than optical luminescence if you're fortunate. It's not always the case, but sometimes you do get a different rate. So if you get the two techniques, thermoluminescence and optical luminescence, on the same sample, you can come up with a much more accurate date. But even then, I'd say plus or minus 50% at best. And probably the Big Bang that's most definitive would be the jewelry Big Bang, because we're the only species of life that builds jewelry and wears jewelry that has no other use except for jewelry. And they found that with some of the finds with the most ancient humans, is that they're actually exploiting shells that have no food value. They've got no construction value. The only value they serve is jewelry. And yet we see an abundance of this stuff in these early finds. And that's the other thing I think is significant. It really is explosive. You know, they have joked, for example, when you go into these ancient human sites, that the quantity of jewelry is about 10 times greater than the quantity of tools. And so it's like, you know, the earliest humans somehow were obsessed with jewelry. And so, you know, trying to find the first evidence of jewelry is one way to get a date for the origin of human beings.
And tattoos also.
Tattoos? Well, well, the problem with tattoos, though, is where how are you going to date a tattoo? So jewelry is a little bit easier. Yes.
In Egyptian history, the earliest Neolithic, well, after Neolithic, was the cosmic palette. And called cosmic because it had stars over the head of a cow. Hathor was a cow. It was a cosmic palace because it was a palace of cosmetics. That's where we get the name. And so women had a lot to do with what we end up with as artifacts.
That's true. Well, I think that's true in most of our households, right? There's more jewelry in our household than there are tools. So I've got sons, so maybe we got more tools than we got jewels. But okay, yeah, let's get into some content here. All right, let's do that. But yeah, sometimes when I go away to speak, I actually learn more than I'm actually there presenting. So, and by the way, we're going to have ongoing dialogue with this whole spectrum of theistic evolutionary belief, and I think we actually did make some progress. I was going to talk about that, but yeah, I'm committed to dive into this. So, the anthropic principle and equality we've been discussing, and this is something that Brandon Carter discovered back in 1983, that given the laws of physics that govern the universe, it's impossible to bring humans upon the cosmic scene in anything less than 14 billion years, but the maximum time we can live in a civilized state is 41,000 years by his calculation, adjusted by Barrow and Tipler in their book, The Cosmological Anthropic Principle. We think it reasons to believe that the figure more likely is closer to 20,000 years. And by the way, this pertains to the problem of trying to come up with a cultural date for the origin of human beings. In fact, you kind of mentioned it. Sometimes what you're really getting at is the origin of the Neolithic Revolution, because that's when you begin to see, you know, cities and towns and transportation systems develop. And so just because you found, say, the most ancient jewelry evidence doesn't mean that's actually the most ancient jewelry around, because you're talking a small human population. The amount of jewelry may be sufficiently small that you're not going to find it. You're actually coming with a date a little bit later than the origin of human beings. And this is kind of where Brandon Carter talked about. He says, you know, trying to determine how long human beings can live at a low population level with no technology, that's more challenging. So he said, let's just see what's possible at the level of the Neolithic Revolution. The Neolithic Revolution took place 11,000 years ago. That's quite well dated. That's when humans began to domesticate animals large scale. What I mean by that is where we find evidence for, say, a family having 1,000 animals of one species. That evidence shows up for the first time 11,000 years ago. That's when you got towns that specialize, say, in making pottery, or other towns that specialize in growing wheat. And this is where they begin to see trading going on between different villages. That's been going on for the past 11,000 years. So if you're looking at our figure, reasons to believe at 20,000 years, that means you only got 9,000 years left before it's all over. And I'm not saying all over. That means it's all over for that level of civilization. If you want to go back to just a few million human beings wandering around with Stone Age tools, you can extend it beyond that 9,000 years. Okay, last time I talked to you, we quickly went through the evidence for why you need the 14 billion years. In order to have advanced life, you need a planet in which you've got continents and a strong, steady magnetic field, and that's going to require a planet with an enormous amount of uranium and thorium embedded in its core, which is going to require the planet to be born at that moment when uranium and thorium hit a peak abundance in the universe. And uranium and thorium are only made in supergiant stars. And so in star formation is aggressive in the early history of the universe, the quantity of uranium and thorium build up, but they're radiometric. So when star formation begins to decline, uranium and thorium decay away. And the half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years. For thorium, 14.1 billion years. And so as you get past that peak, the abundance of uranium and thorium decline. Bottom line is, if you want a planet where advanced life is going to be possible, that planet must form when the universe is at its peak uranium and thorium abundance, which means you'd want our planet to form when the universe is a little more than 9 billion years old. And that would have been 4.5 billion years ago. And we live in a planet that's 4.5 billion years old, so the numbers all work out. But of course, it raises the question, well, why didn't God bring us here any earlier? Well, we've mentioned the fact that when we look on the crust of the Earth, we can see evidence of relic natural nuclear reactors. In other words, it's not just uranium-238, you've got uranium-235. And that's what they make atomic bombs out of. You don't make an atomic bomb out of U-238. It's not going to result in a runaway fission reaction. Uranium-235 will. It has a half-life of 705 million years. And so you don't want to be around on planet Earth if you're a human being when there's lots of uranium-235 around. In fact, this particular site in Akwa, Gabon in Africa, that water would come into contact with uranium-235, and water acts as a medium to concentrate the uranium-235, and so that will set off a natural nuclear bomb in that area. But what that once the nuclear reaction gets going, it evaporates the water. And when the water evaporates, it shuts down the nuclear reaction. but then the water returns and the nuclear reaction starts up again. So what you got here is actually a cycling fission uranium bomb going on and off, on and off, on and off as the water returns and the water evaporates. But that gives you an idea. If you're a human being wandering around on a planet at that time, you're not going to last long because of the radiation damage from the uranium-235, which is one reason why you'll want to wait about 4.5 billion years, where the uranium-235 is to decay to such an extreme level there's hardly any left. In fact, that's the real challenge, say, with Iran trying to make nuclear weapons right now. They have to mine all this uranium and separate out the uranium-235 from the uranium-238. And only a tiny amount of the uranium we mine today is uranium-235. And then trying to pull it out and concentrate it is a significant technological challenge because there's so little left. But because there's so little left, we humans can wander around the planet without any major risk. So that's one reason why we're actually looking at 13.75 billion years before you bring humans upon the cosmic scene, and then not bringing us on, say, when the Earth formed 4.5 billion years ago. And I think this is where we ended up last time. This is the second reason why you want to wait those extra 4.5 billion years. Because the sun is very unstable when it's young. It's unstable in several ways. One is its luminosity. What you can see here is when the sun is first formed, it's rapidly accumulating mass, and the luminosity of a star goes up with a fourth power of its mass, and therefore we had the sun actually doubling in brightness in a relatively short period of time. Then it starts to lose mass. It loses about up to 20% of its mass, and therefore the luminosity drops and it reaches a level of about 85% of where it is now. Thereafter, it slowly increases in brightness because at this point it stops losing mass. So it's not losing any significant mass from this point onward. Then what's taking place here is you have hydrogen being fused into helium in the core of the sun. That's the nuclear fusion reaction that makes the sun shine the way it does. But as hydrogen is converted into helium, that increases the density of the core of the sun, which actually makes its nuclear furnace burn more efficiently. So the sun has been getting progressively brighter and brighter as we continue. But you want to have, human beings require a certain solar luminosity. It existed here, it existed here, and it existed here. But you don't want to be here or here, because we got too much changes going on in the brightness of the sun. This is where the sun's brightness is changing the least, when you got the appropriate luminosity for human beings. So you kind of run the line here, and what is that? 4.57 billion years is where you want to be if you're a human being. You don't want to be back here when the sun is young. There's other reasons why you don't want to be back there. That's the time when the Earth is being heavily bombarded by asteroids and comets. That's not very pleasant for building cities like Los Angeles. You don't want the city to be bombarded every week or so by a major asteroidal collision event. But here's another reason, and this has to do with solar flaring activity. As I've mentioned before, stars are just like human beings. They're unstable when they're young. They're unstable when they're old. They're maximally stable when they're middle-aged. And so the sun reaches a minimum flaring activity, a minimum X-ray radiation flow from the sun when it's 4.57 billion years old. You say, why that 4.57? Well, stars reach their maximum stability when they've gone through half of their nuclear burning history. And our sun can burn for slightly more than 9 billion years. You divide that by 2, and that's the time where you get the maximum stability. Bottom line, we human beings are living at the best time in the history of the sun in terms of its luminosity, in terms of its X-ray radiation, and in terms of its flaring activity. I mean, here we are coming into solar maximum. We're just a few months away from solar maximum, but the flaring that we're getting of the sun is pretty tepid. In fact, people have been complaining that they're not being able to see much in the way of an aurora borealis, this particular solar maximum. Well, maybe better luck 11 years from now. Might get a little more spectacular thing. But notice, even the most active solar maxima, like the one that took place in the mid-1950s, where people all over the planet were seeing aurora, it was still such that it was at no danger to human beings at all. In fact, the biggest danger now from a solar maxima flaring is that it might disrupt some of our GPS satellites. Well, like what my son said about that, Dad, if that happens, that would be the end of civilization as we know it. So, but the other thing I'll say about this before we close up here is that of all the stars that exist in our galaxy, our sun has the best possible mass to minimize the amount of flaring activity. Stars more massive than our sun have greater flaring activity. Suns less massive than our sun also have greater flaring activity. There's a reason why God chose our star, the sun, and made sure it had the mass that it does. That's where you get the minimum flaring. As I've already mentioned, that flaring minimum occurs when the sun is 4.57 billion years old. And I think I've mentioned this before, too, is that physicists, in measuring neutrinos coming out of the sun in an experiment that took place about 7 years ago, determined that the sun entered an exceptionally stable phase in its luminosity starting 50,000 years ago. But that exceptional luminosity will only persist for a maximum of another 50,000 years. So right there, I think you get a good feel for this inequality that Brandon Carter is talking about. You need that 14 billion years to get human beings upon the cosmic scene. But just based on this neutrino study, the maximum time we can live at that ideal solar luminosity stability is no wider than 100,000 years. That would also probably argue for God creating Adam and Eve somewhere in the neighborhood of about 50,000 years ago. That would be at the beginning of the solar luminosity phase, and then wrapping things up before that 50,000 year ends. So if you're a student of Bible prophecy, that means the Lord will return in less than 50,000 years from now, because after that, the sun's luminosity won't be as stable as it is right now. Yes?
But the Lord would have to return substantially earlier than that, because 50,000 years from now, we won't be smart enough or aware enough to appreciate it.
Well, all I'm looking at here is one time window.
Yeah.
The truth is, I mean, if you look at why the universe is the way it is, I described several windows of time that must be met in order for us to be able to engage in global high-technology civilization. This is just one, which says the maximum window is 100,000 years. But there are other windows that would argue for a briefer period of time. Some of them are broader, but the real challenge is this. All the windows have to line up. So you might have, say, three windows that are 100,000 years wide each, but if one is here and one is here and one is over there, you're going to get a rather narrow slice where all three are there at the same time. So this is kind of the rationale of the debate. Is it 41,000 years? Is it 20,000 years? Is it something less? Is it something more? And what about the sociological factors? We'll talk about that, but there's actually factors in terms of what if the civilization level goes up? And kind of where Frank Tipler and John Barrow are coming from, it's one thing to argue with the window of time we have if we're talking Neolithic level civilization. But if we're talking civilization that existed post-World War II, the window is much narrower. So the debate over how wide the window is all based on what level of civilization you're willing to tolerate. So I talked to my sons, they can't think of a world without GPS satellites. So if we want a world that's that advanced, continuing on, we're probably not looking at anything near 20,000 years. It's going to be considerably narrower than that.
What if
we
need to close
for
another planet?
Well, I'll just close with that. I mean, I've heard Hawking actually argue that these time windows are much narrower than what Barrow and Tipler claim, and that we need to be engaged in the next 1,000 years of abandoning planet Earth and finding another planet that we can all go to, because Earth isn't going to be able to support us at our level of civilization for anything even approaching just another 1,000 years. The problem is none of the planets in our solar system would be candidates. Yeah, you can go to Mars. If you're prepared to spend a minimum of $400 quadrillion, you can make Mars habitable for about a 60-year period. Well, that's a lot of money to spend on something that's only going to keep you going an extra 60 years. What you really need to do, and Hawking makes this point, we're going to have to go to another planetary system. The problem is we've already looked at 700 planets outside of our solar system. None of them show the characteristics that would make possible the existence of another planet in the same system with the capability of supporting advanced life. Bottom line, it's what God told us in Genesis 1. Adam and Eve and your descendants, I'm putting you in charge of the planet to manage it for the benefit of all life. Take good care of it. You go to the book of Job, you'll see a 5-chapter-long manual on how to take good care of planet Earth. But the warning there is that if you don't follow those instructions in the book of Job, that window of time is going to get dramatically shorter. And so if you want to keep the window wide, God has told you how to do it, but there's a limit even then. And the limit apparently is in the order of thousands of years, not millions of years. And therefore, the idea of going somewhere else just isn't practical. By the way, I don't think it's even possible to travel across interstellar space. Somebody was complaining to me in class about, I've got to be disturbed in thinking that Star Wars and Star Trek isn't real. You do violate the laws of physics at least 8 times a minute when you're watching a Star Trek episode, right? So, so we are stuck with this planet. It's the one place that God has given us. And on my debate with Victor Stenger, that's the one thing that he and I have both agreed on. The universe, as big as it is hostile to advanced life, except for this one tail blue dot in which we're on. We better make the best of it. But the good news is, God has promised to take us from this universe to a brand new realm, the new creation, once we complete the task that He set before us. He says, I've given you the mission of taking the good news of salvation through Jesus Christ to all the people groups of the world. Once that's been done, the universe will have fulfilled its purpose, and then God has promised to replace this realm with a brand new realm where we don't have to worry about these narrow time windows. We're going to be able to live for all of eternity in the new creation, but not until the fullness of the number of people who receive Jesus Christ and Lord and Savior has been reached. That's Romans 8:23.
Would a mass mailing be sufficient?
No, when I say no more questions, the 5 minutes.
I'm already 5 minutes over, so I'm going to pray.
You can't follow instructions here, so please follow my instructions. No questions come until after 7 minutes.
Okay. Father in heaven, I want to thank you for this time that we've had together. And Lord, we thank you for this unique time in which we all get to live and see these amazing revelations from your book of nature and book of scripture unfold. And Father, I pray that you would give us the humility to submit to what you've revealed. Lord, that we would recognize the offer that you've made to each one of us to leave this creation and enter the new creation. And Lord, I pray that you would give us the humility to receive that offer, but also the motivation to present that offer to others. Lord, that we can gain that fullness of the number of people in a short period of time rather than a long period of time. In Jesus' name, amen.
Excuse me. Conquering all evil and suffering, that's the new creation, right?
Right.
But